Hey everybody, welcome back to another Bald Move Prestige movie. This time we're talking about 2019's black and white classic one-to-one or nearly one-to-one ratio shot film, The Lighthouse. It's directed by Robert Eggers, which you may recall he directed this little 2015 movie called The Witch, which Jim and I really, really enjoyed.
Yeah.
It's more like Vitch because it's spelled with two V's. It's a really long, drawn-out V. It was written by Robert Eggers with his brother, Max Eggers, loosely based on the final unfinished work of fiction by Edgar Allan Poe, The Lighthouse. Also apparently based on a real-life story, loosely, the Smalls Lighthouse Tragedy of 1801. I found it had a lot of like the telltale hearts in it, or more like the telltale farts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it stars Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe and maybe 30 seconds of some other human beings, but it's all these guys in very limited space. This movie is shot to feel claustrophobic. What did you think of this film? Because if I start talking, I might not stop for 20 minutes.
I feel you, man, because I thought this movie was incredible. I loved it. And let me preface all this by saying I don't know that I fully understand it. I don't know that I came away with anything that this movie wanted to tell me, but the experience of watching it was so good that I didn't feel like any of that mattered, and I thought I got just enough of what they were putting down to feel like it was worth my time. And The Witch is one of my favorite horror movies of the modern era, of the last decade at least. I think it's fantastic in creating a mood, and the tension. I don't recall what the trailer was like, but I know a lot of people were saying, oh, the trailer, you know, makes it seem as if it's going to be just another horror movie with a series of jump scares and bullshit. Turns out it was nothing like that. It was the exact type of mood and horror that I want from my horror films. And this brings a similar eerie sort of tension to the table. And it does it with not just some truly astounding performances from those two main actors that you were talking about, but the way that it uses the cinematography and the sound, it all creates this muddy mess which is intentional, right? Like I say muddy mess in the best way possible. You aren't sure if the thing you're seeing in the distance is a ship come to save you or a body come to haunt you, right? Like you're not sure if the sound you're hearing is a foghorn, if it's a creaking board, or if it's a low rumbling fart from the protagonist. Like, it's just this confusing mess of a foggy stew that feels incredible to watch, to experience.
Yeah, I mean, there's moments of this film where I literally laughed out loud at like the absurdity or the crudity that was happening. There's moments where I covered my mouth in like shock and horror. Mm-hmm. There are just crazy visuals and audio phenomenon committed to this film. There's a scene late in the film that I think it's just going to stay with me forever. I had been saving this movie like a bottle of fine wine. Knew that everybody was loving it. I'm one of those who has been quietly impressed with Robert Pattinson's post-Twilight career. You know, it's sad. The boy lost a sparkle in this film. He's not he's not shining at all. But what he is doing is just doing a raw, searing performance and standing toe-to-toe with Willem Dafoe at his most unhinged, corked up and primed and ready to blow on you.
Man, I went through Willem Dafoe's IMDb catalog looking for a film that I thought he was better in, and I couldn't find it. This is like a career defining performance from both of these guys, in my opinion.
Especially since he's such a unique looking individual, and this film makes full use of his just like wide eyes and his like improbable array of teeth and his increasingly craggy features and his wiry beard and his shock of hair. Like he looks like the saltiest dog that is washed up on the shore. He was a son of a gun, born between two cannons midships of a sailing vessel that shipwrecked an old age and washed him up on this rock. And now he's a wiki serving this lighthouse. Like, he's just this the way he talks, like a pirate from the Caribbean, mm-hmm. And you've got Robert Pattinson as like just a Boston baked bean.
Sure.
But again, it's like there's so much just crazy that doesn't seem like it should work, let alone be horrific or scary, and yet it is. I mean, is scary the right word? It's more of just like
there's just an enormous amount of tension in this movie. And I compare it, the only thing I can compare it to, and the things that I immediately noticed, and I think the movie is leaning into, is comparisons with The Shining. The Shining has a similar amount of dread and tension and, you know, disturbing, unsettling visuals that aren't in and of themselves particularly horrific. It's just
It's funny because, like, this guy with the witch, which worked mostly because of his mastery at building tension and then releasing it and just sheer atmospheric dread. It's a lot like I've really enjoyed the works of James Wan. You know, I guess what would you call him? Like the master of like not quite the jump scare, but like it's the camera pull. Like there's misdirection. Like, you know, the like, oh shit, that thing in the background that you didn't even notice is now the scariest thing you've ever seen. And like, you know, trying to build jump scares in plain sight. Uncanny, maybe that. This guy just is with setting and use of light and shadow and sound is able to build horrific things out of fairly mundane. You know, I've always actually kind of fantasized about being a lighthouse keeper. I thought it would be a cool job. Yeah. Like, yeah, you get you're stuck at sea in a snug little quarters with you know, some routine manual labor and some books to keep you company and a fire to maybe have a dog there with you. That would be kind of like an idealized existence for certain for parts of me at certain times of my life.
Sure.
And this film is a repudiation of all of those dreams because it doesn't. I would get stationed Willem Dafoe and and bad things would start happening to me.
Stuck alone with an old man and his thoughts.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, it's one of those things where, like, I think a detailed discussion of this movie really wouldn't spoil things. But on the other hand, I went into this movie knowing nothing except for it had a very stark look. It was shot kind of deliberately to ape that classic silver screen of Hollywood, that very silvery emulsion or whatever in a film that made it not just black and white. Like, this calling this black and white doesn't do the movie justice. It's truly silver. And it had very well regarded performances by Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe. I remember being excited when I originally heard that this was attached to the same guy. This is the second film, his follow up from The Witch. This Robert Eggers. But by the time I sat down to watch it last night, I had forgotten about that. So I kind of rediscovered it when I was doing my research. But yeah, it's such an experience, and I'm with you. There's a couple things in this film that seem very open to a plain reading of it.
Yeah.
But then there's a lot of like a couple of details I didn't catch, which we're going to talk about, that I got on research that like I think will make this movie a very rewarding rewatch to see, because there's multiple also like there's every once in a while like one out of 10 movies I read or we watch and I can read like an infinity amount of reviews of and like people's thoughts and opinions. And this, I saw like four or five really compelling interpretations that may or may not hold up on repeat watch, but God, it's just great.
Yeah, this is a movie that I'm not going to understand why I feel the way I feel about it for another 5-10 years. Like, I'm going to have to see this movie multiple times, think about its themes and its messages, and try somewhere along the way to understand how I feel about it. But my initial reaction was, holy shit, that was amazing. And it's so easy to watch. That's the thing that surprised me about it, I guess, because I went into it thinking, okay, I better hold on to my butt because this thing is going to be heavy and it's going to be, you know, like a Roma kind of thing where I've got to sit through it almost. And then by the time...
Yeah, really eat your vegetables.
Yeah. But then 5 minutes in, Willem Dafoe had farted in Robert Pattinson's face twice, and I'm like, oh, what is this thing? And I kept asking and I'm re-asking while watching it, what is this thing? But every time I asked it, I felt better about what it was for whatever it was.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers have a chance to exercise their rights under the Patreon pact we've made by voting for the next pulp movie that Jim and I will be covering. If you're one of the elite few backers at the executive producer level, don't miss your chance to influence us. Hurry over to patreon.com/baldmove and vote in the latest movie poll before it closes on Wednesday morning.
And for all other club members, we've got an all-new episode of Lunch with Jim and Aaron this Friday afternoon. Catch the live stream at 1 p.m. to interact with us and your fellow munchers over on Patreon, or you can wait for the podcast to drop later that day.
If you want even more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
Okay, well, maybe we should do the thing where we do a synopsis of the film to tell people, you know, what this is about if they've not seen it before, and then we can get into the heavy-duty spoilers, because I think there's very little we can say about this film other than its premise that you should go in knowing almost nothing about this film, because it's part of it is the experience, and I wouldn't want to rob anyone of that. The film's premise is this is in the late 18th century, I would say, somewhere in the 1880s, 1890s point of view. You have two men going to an offshore lighthouse, a far offshore lighthouse somewhere on the east coast of the United States, and they're going to take a 4-week stint of manning this lighthouse before they'll be relieved. There's one very experienced Wiki or lighthouse keeper played by Willem Dafoe. And there is a rookie, a person who did work for log camp and is wanting to seek a new life on the sea. And he is joining him for his first stint to hopefully start his life over. And that's the movie. These men have to deal with each other through labor, through conversations, through storms. They have to endure each other's company, take solace from each other's company until the tender comes back to pick them up 4 weeks later. Mm-hmm. It's an hour 40 of that. And the thing you'll notice right away is the sound design.
Oh, God.
The oppressive, constant bleeding of this foghorn, this insanely loud thing that never stops. You'll notice the claustrophobic, nearly box framing of, you know, like the rarely seen widescreen, or I guess narrow screen black bars on the sides of the film in this case.
Yeah, it's a 4:3 aspect ratio, and it's immediately jarring.
Yes.
You notice it right off the bat.
And you'll also notice this is not just black and white. This is nearly monochromatic, extremely high contrast, extreme, like when a source of light comes on, it nearly blinds the camera. When things are dark, it's like the film is rolling in oil. The visuals are stark, and that's the backdrop in which this film takes place. I want to talk about some of the influences, because I thought there was a lot of the Edgar Allan Poe, especially the Telltale Heart, like someone being driven mad by someone else's existence. Okay. There's a lot of like Lovecraftian Cthulhu horror in the margins of this film, mm-hmm. you know, dealing with like half human hybrids, check. Typically beasts, check. Arcane things happening in the midnight hours by some old crazy person, check. And I think it doesn't really embrace any of those, but it draws on like my subconscious knowledge of these tales to kind of like having me jump at shadows throughout various points in the movie, where like I'm like, oh, I think I know where they're going with this. Whereas by the time I get done with the movie, I really not even sure what I saw or my interpretation of it. What did you think about that? The influences that you saw?
I mean, there are some very, very overt ones. I'm not even familiar. I wouldn't even call myself a novice when it comes to Greek mythology and the, you know, mythology of the gods. But like the Prometheus angle is just totally unmistakable. It is the last shot of this movie, and it's also, it permeates the entire thing.
If you play through the God of War campaigns, you'll understand 90% of mythology in this film.
Right. And one of those shots being just a very an extremely striking visual of Willem Dafoe completely naked, standing in front of a kneeling Robert Pattinson, beaming light into his face from his own eyes. It's shit like that with Zeus and Prometheus and like the taking of the fire or giving it to humanity and creating their society and their intelligence. And like, you feel all of that. And this is why I say it'll take me another 5-10 years to understand how I feel about this movie. 'Cause I feel it. I don't know what it means necessarily.
Did you see that shot was a reconstruction of this 1904 painting by a person named Sasha Schneider?
No, but I did see that the last shot is very, very similar to a painting.
About Prometheus. So there's this idea, and I got, when I saw that shot, I didn't recognize obviously the painting it was based on, but it made me think of like I had this interpretation I was building that like maybe Willem Dafoe was the lighthouse.
Okay.
Because he's got this light blazing out and he's illuminating. He's also like constantly warning the Robert Pattinson's character of the danger that he's in. Like, oh, you can't bully the seabirds, lad. And you shouldn't spill your beans and you're, you know, like he's kind of like the lighthouse for Robert Pattinson's soul. Uh-huh. But then when I saw that film, when I saw that shot, I'm like, ah, that seals it. But then like the third act of the movie kind of veers away from that. And now, that's the thing. It's like the crucial detail that I missed in the first time through is I didn't get that the seagull that was tormenting Robert Pattinson had only one eye, okay. Which ties into Willem Dafoe's previous lighthouse buddy having one eye, which ties into Robert Pattinson, right? Him pulling up the lobster trap and seeing the one-eyed, you know, head that was in it. But then Robert Pattinson has one eye at the end, and there's a whole other line of interpretation in this film that like this is like, you understand that Robert Pattinson was on this thing alone the entire time, and like Willem Dafoe was his subconscious.
This is where I feel like the Shining stuff starts to come back in, right? It's like, I mean, there are so many overt references to The Shining in this, but also, yeah, that idea of like he has always been here, right? You know, Grady telling Jack Torrance that, you know, you've always been here, him in the photo from forever ago. It gets that feeling of like, I'm not quite sure how any of this is possible, but that's kind of the point. And I feel you. At times I felt like Robert Pattinson was, you know, that old wiki come back to haunt Willem Dafoe's character, Thomas. And at times I felt like Thomas was there simply to torment Ephraim, I think is his name.
Mm-hmm. Well, but it's not, right?
Right, it's also Thomas, but that's just fucking confusing. I'm not going to say that.
Yeah. There's the two Thomases. But I think that's one of the interpretation that I would be trying to poke holes at the next time I watch is that these two men that are named Thomas, the Willem Dafoe version is his subconscious, mm-hmm. and the Robert Pattinson is his active consciousness. You'll notice that, like, Robert Pattinson is always doing his work by day. Willem Dafoe is always doing his work by night.
And
Pattinson only has like a dim understanding of what's going on, which you would, you know, like if you dimly understand your subconscious, and you only really interface with it when you first awake and when you're preparing for bed, which is the times that they have their in-depth conversations. Because, like, you know, and like the fact that this might even be like some kind of recurring purgatory that he's stuck in, because that's Prometheus stole forbidden knowledge, fire, tried to give it to mortals, and then his punishment was he was going to have his guts ripped out and his liver pecked away, and then that liver would regenerate and the punishment would begin anew. And there's a lot there that, like, you know, it could be that Robert Pattinson is a lighthouse keeper that just keeps murdering his assistants. That he's, you know, that this Willem Dafoe character is just his subconscious, like, reminding him of that. There's also, like, with the liver and alcoholism being a core of this, like, there's another way to interpret this is that Robert Pattinson's character is a newly dried alcoholic. And his liver's metaphorically regenerating through his abstinence, only to be torn down by ever more increasingly violent alcoholic binges, to the point where at the end of the movie, he's drinking turpentine with honey to get his fix.
Yeah. What do they call it? Monkey pump. Monkey pump.
Monkey pump.
I gotta make a drink called Monkey Pump. I want it to have honey.
It's one part turpentine, one part honey, Jim. They got the recipe film.
I'd put gin. What are they drinking through most of this? Gin, I think.
Oh, God, yeah. It's either gin or vodka, probably gin.
Yeah, they mentioned gin a few times. So it'd be gin and honey and I don't know what else.
A little bit of turpentine.
Maybe some grass. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, there you go. How do you chew grass? You rip it out and you swallow it.
How do you eat grass with no teeth? You drink it.
So I think that's the but when I was watching it the first time, my primary lens is like, this is an examination of the effects of gaslighting someone.
Oh yeah.
Because
feels like they are being gaslit the entire time.
Many times in this film, there are things that we see Willem Dafoe do that then he directly accuses Robert Pattinson of doing.
Yeah.
You know, like in the end of the movie, it's like very explicit. Like Robert Pattinson's trying to steal the dinghy to get the hell off of that island, wearing his little cork life preserver, and Willem Dafoe comes out there, smashes it up, chases him into the cabin, and then says, "You've done lost your mind, laddie. You just destroyed our only lifeboat." Mm-hmm. And
it's been 4 also, weeks when, you know, it's maybe been a night of intense drinking. We're not sure.
That's the other thing I kept on wondering is, like, is it possible that Willem Dafoe is just fucking with this guy and it's taking it too far? Like, they've only been there a week and he said, "Oh no, we've been here for 4 weeks. The tender's coming tomorrow. Drink up." And then he drinks and, "Oh, maybe we missed it. Oh, now there's a storm coming. We don't have any like,
maybe."
There is a little hint of that too, because again, in the third act, when they start drinking turpentine, who the fuck knows what's happening? Like,
oh, yeah.
Your brain's melting.
Right.
Like, you can't trust, these are two highly unreliable narrators, if there's two narrators at all.
Yeah. You lose all sense of time, which I think is part of what makes this extremely tense and confusing.
Because that's the other thing, is I was shocked when it was time for the tender to pick up. Like, there has only seemed like there has been 3 or 4 morning and night cycles. But yeah, you could easily believe that, like, well, I, you know, like, shit, you know, there's the passage of time. Who knows? I haven't exactly been keeping track myself. The men's physical appearance never really changes. Mm-hmm. So, like, there's not like, oh, Robert Pattinson starts growing out a beard, so you can tell. There's really nothing. There's no calendar. There's a There's like a clock that tells the time and a barometer that tells like how fucked the weather is, but there's no other indication of how long they've been there.
Yeah, really, it's just their mentality, you know. It's the degradation of their psyches that is marking time here. And it's interesting too, because this movie keeps you in that tense mode throughout the majority of the runtime. And it's doing it with a lot of different things, but there are a lot of movies that would have gone pretty traditional routes where I could see the ending, you know, and I could see the murder. And to some degree, I did see the murder here coming up, but also certainly not in the way that I expected it to happen. And nothing leading up to it was what I expected. And there's a lot of like scenes where they're extremely drunk and arguing, and you know, one moment they're dancing around the table in a mad jig, and then the next moment they're shouting at each other, threatening murder, and it always just like there's a strange ebb and flow to it that like you think this is it, this is the moment, everything's going to come to a head here, and they're going to start trading blows, and someone's going to get killed, and it calms back down with a joke or a fart or something, right? And then only to maybe even flare up again in the same scene, even.
Or to have that violent tension be converted to homoerotic.
Yeah, yeah.
Sexual energy.
I think there are
at one
themes
point of
yeah, like masculinity and sexuality, and like all of those things are in here. And with, you know, around this framework of the lighthouse, which is a phallic symbol. So, like, there are a myriad of themes going on here that I am not fully competent confident that I can tease out of this thing.
Yeah, there's also something about like the craving of a father figure's approval.
Sure.
And I thought that was, but then like, boy, the thing that like I don't understand at all is walking Willem Dafoe like a dog.
Okay, yeah, I'm with you. No idea.
Like, that's where the things, like, I was like, you know, they had this violent energy, and then they start dancing. And there's that's a breathtaking scene, because these guys are just tear-assing. These big physical men are just tear-assing in this, like, 6x6 area with a table. There's, like, lanterns. Like, Robert Pattinson viciously just kicks away a prop, and it kind of, like, continues to be kicked. Like, how do you even choreograph that thing? And then that turns into them slow dancing, which turns into, I think, Willem Dafoe trying to kiss Robert Pattinson, which then turns into a vicious beating, which then turns into him literally walking him like a dog and burying him alive.
Uh-huh.
Again, I don't know how much of that stuff literally fucking happened.
Fair. Yeah.
I don't know how much of any of this, because the whole film could be like, you know, I could easily interpret it as like a purgatory state, except for like, I guess my default, I've seen It's All a Dream like be used as it seemed like the laziest type of critical analysis, like, oh, what if it's just all a fucking dream? So I kind of shy away from that, but there's nothing that directly contradicts that, you know.
No, it has that quality to it though. Like I said, the Shining references are all over this place. He murders him with an axe. They're talking about some frostbitten maniac roaming the woods, is exactly how The Shining ends. Like, there are 100 different ways that The Shining is in here, and most of all, it's the feeling of uncertainty about the nature of what's happening. And I think that's where this movie shines to me. No pun intended.
Shines like Willem Dafoe's eye sockets,
or like Danny Torrance.
There's, like I said, the other plain reading is like Willem Dafoe just fucking with this guy. Like, you know, he's offensively, like, the first couple of introductions, it just seems like he is trying to provoke a reaction from Robert Pattinson's character. And there's like this hole in his bed that this scrimshaw mermaid stuck into, which becomes like this totem that kind of drives him insane. And he's just constantly like, there's this thing where he's whitewashing the lighthouse on this like little bosun's chair, and Willem Dafoe drops him, but it's never addressed or dealt with.
Yeah.
And then he like provokes Robert Pattinson to rage. It looks like he's going to get a thrashing, and then he suddenly becomes meek and submissive, and yeah, there's like when Robert Pattinson stands up, like after he smacks him for like saying, you know, your superstition about the birds is bullshit, there's this giant diabolical shadow that looms behind Robert Pattinson, and it looks like that's what scares Willem Dafoe. And I think that was kind of one an early thing that's interesting, that like he saw something in him. But it's so crazy because there's like there's this imagery of these rolling logs and this corpse in the sea that is a version of something that happened to him and his foreman in the, you know, I guess it's the Nantucket Bay.
Yeah.
You know, whether he deliberately murdered the guy or whether he passively watched an accident and didn't do anything about it. But that there's sometimes that when Robert Pattinson has a scene where he goes to empty the night buckets, you see these logs of shit rolling around in that piss bucket. Huh. And it's exactly the same metaphor, the visual metaphor of the logs rolling. And it's like one of those things where like sometimes I just felt like this film was just on the edge of like pulling my leg.
Oh, yeah. I mean, every time Willem Dafoe rips a fart, I'm like, okay, how serious am I supposed to treat this thing? Like, you've got this ultra serious tone for most of it, but then it's just interrupted and injected with these farts, which was delightful to me. I loved every second of it, but it does. It leaves me asking the question, like, how seriously do you want me to take this film?
Right, and like there's a scene of Robert Pattinson furiously masturbating in the engine room, and he's fantasizing about this mermaid character that he saw, the Scrimshaw mermaid, and then there's this close up picture of her mermaid vagina,
mermaid puss,
right as he climbs her wet mermaid pussy, right as he's climaxing, but it like ruins it for him somehow, which might feed into the homoeroticism, or maybe just like, you know, like it's pretty gross looking fish puss.
And some of that stuff, you're right, is weird. Like, so the mermaid statue figurine or whatever comes out of this hole in the mattress, and you almost get the impression that like all of this could be not really happening. Like maybe when he's envisioning the mermaid puss or whatever, he's over there like fucking this hole in his mattress where this mermaid figurine came out of, like,
right.
I don't know what I'm supposed to think.
Right.
Cause I don't think he's literally like I don't think there are any mermaids that are real in this film.
Bold stance to come out against mermaids like that.
I don't think there's, some tentacled fish monster up in the top of the lighthouse, but yet he sees that. And
I've seen Willem Dafoe's dick, and it's been like 10 years. Maybe it developed some suckers on it. You know, that thing's a monster.
Maybe. I mean, he's naked. Seen his dick. He's naked up there.
He's naked up there every night. So, you know, I could buy that. I could buy that.
Yeah. I don't know. It's fucked up, but I loved it.
We try to make it super easy to support Making Podcast a Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
Yeah, and then just like there's so much amazing dialogue in this film. Like almost everything that comes out of Willem Dafoe's face is amazing.
Let me first preface this and say that I had to turn on the subtitles in this movie because I couldn't understand a goddamn word. I turned my sound system up as loud as I dared, and it didn't matter. Oh, yeah, like it wasn't a problem of hearing the words; it was a problem of understanding what the fuck they were saying.
Yeah, it's very much like Brad Pitt's pikey dialogue from Snatch. Like it's this very heavy seagoing vernacular that I actually didn't find as tough sledding. Maybe it's because I just watched four Pirates of the Caribbean films. Maybe it's because this is a lot like this vernacular is familiar from the Patrick O'Brien series that I love so much. But
right.
There is a couple of there's a scene where they get in a fight over Willem Dafoe's cooking, and Willem Dafoe launches on like a 3-minute long unbroken nautical curse that he unleashes on Robert Pattinson. And it's one of the most remarkable things I've ever seen. Like the camera never cuts away from Willem Dafoe's crazy face, and he's just saying, just damning him with Poseidon's asshole and Triton's dick and Proteus's armpit, and you'll be a blasted film, the nothing of your soul that'll be consigned to the Emperor of the Deep, whatever. Just goes on and on and on, and then like the both men kind of sink to the floor panting, and there's this crazy tension. It's broken by Robert Pattinson saying, "Fine, have it your way. I like your cooking."
Right.
And then that's the end of the scene.
There are no less than two of those from Willem Dafoe in this movie. When he's also talking about like how if I ask you to do this and I ask you to do that, you'll do it with a smile on your face in the most flowery sea dog prose you've ever seen or heard.
Yes.
And that's not the limit of it. Robert Pattinson also has one of those. Just epic. I've never seen anything like it. Dialogues.
I hate monologues. Your rants. I hate your goddamn. It's all in this like thick Boston bean. I hate your goddamn farts.
Your goddamn farts.
And your rancid foreskin. You smell like smegma and like
it's curdled foreskin. I've never heard insults like this. Yeah. It's incredible. Absolutely incredible. I cannot understand how these two actors were not nominated, at least fucking nominated for Academy Awards that year. Leonardo DiCaprio got nominated for his performance in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. This is light years better than that. Light years from both of these guys.
Yeah, it's a demand. It seemed like it was a demanding shoot. They're constantly wet and in this cramped environment. They're just screaming at maximum volume to each other with, I thought, fairly interesting. Like, Robert Pattinson's Boston was interesting because, like, when he's calmer and less sober, it seemed like he was suppressing it pretty well.
Yeah.
But then, like, he played it up. Like, the angrier and the more drunk he got, the more the Boston baked bean came out. None of this was easy work to do either. I guess this film did get a theatrical release, so it should have been under consideration, but like I knew it as kind of like a Netflix original.
Oh, and it was. It was nominated for Best Cinematography.
Yeah.
In the 92nd Academy Awards. So like it was eligible, totally.
Do you think there's just a little bit of chauvinism that this didn't get this didn't go onto the theater big? Because I don't understand how they didn't get a nom. I mean,
and that scene alone with Willem Dafoe, going on his tirade, but then like that was just one of so many scenes that are like that. The scene where he's being buried alive is
God.
I have to imagine traumatic for an actor. Like it's a single shot that's doing a close zoom on his face as dirt is being dumped onto him, and it's a good long 3-minute scene. And the entire time they start dumping dirt on his chest, but as he's ranting at Ephraim, he's progressively, like, it's coming up toward his face. And eventually,
starts burying
he's
his
just
face.
Being hit in the face with shovels of dirt, still ranting. Dirt, you can tell, in his eyes, in his mouth. He's having a hard time even getting through that scene. And yet the performance is incredible.
This is Sam Raimi shoveling dirt on Bruce Campbell in Army of Darkness, only it lasts 3 minutes. And he's reciting Shakespeare through it.
Right.
And you can tell, like, it's getting in his eyes, it's getting in his nose, it's starting to choke his mouth, and he's just, like, adding that, like, to the, because that's what the guy would really be struggling with down in the depths of this being buried.
Yeah. You could probably hear it in the tone of my voice, but I was thoroughly impressed with the actors.
Yeah, no, and then, and this, again, this film is such a, I won't say it's a pleasure to watch, because it's an assault. But isn't a chore. Like you said, like, you know, when you see, like, oh, God, this, like, really high concept, black and white, weird aspect ratio, old-timey techniques and minimalist setting and set. Although I thought the set design was pretty, like, they built this. Did you know this? They built this lighthouse. This movie cost $4 million. They built this lighthouse from scratch.
Rip. Huh. No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was purpose-built for this film. And like all, like I thought the set design, even though it's very minimalist as far as its size, it's like, I've been into a lot of these old lighthouses. Like Beaver Island's got like three different lighthouses, one that you can actually climb up to the top and see the thing. And like I felt like a lot of familiarity. These look exactly like these old abandoned decrepit lighthouses that were. It's so wild because it's one of those things where they have, like, relatively speaking, in human history, these lighthouses only were around for 100, 200 years, and then they all were replaced in the middle of the 20th century by radio beacons and automatic things. And, like, it's kind of like the same where, like, you know, they used to have, you know, guys that ran the back of the train, the caboose guys that lived in these, like, little tiny cabins that were pulled along by the railroad, and they'd do signal switching and stuff like that. Like, they had these, there's this career that was vital for the industry of a nation and the world for 50, 60 years, and then it's gone. It's just gone overnight. And these wikis are the exact same way. And I don't know, like, there's... I love the detail. Like, Willem Dafoe's character has like a old sailing ship tattooed on his chest because, you know, he grew up in an era where it was the last of this age of sail before the ironclads and the steamships took over.
Yeah.
All this crazy like upheavals in technology and careers and, you know, people used to, like, at this time were getting paid to fill up street lamps with whale oil.
Right.
That was a career you could have. That was a job. And then they would be delivering milk. And now they're driving Uber. There's a lot of like really weird kind of like societal dread of change. And, you know, there's a little bit of like this new guy threatening this old guy's position, if you want to read it that way,
that
too.
Really, really falls in line with like the Prometheus myth, right? Like,
right.
You know, Zeus, I am certain, had to feel challenged by Prometheus stealing the fire from him and tricking him. Like, all the things that Prometheus does to Zeus. That seed change is unsettling, certain.
Do you want to talk about some of just like the crazy imagery? Because, like, again, I think we talked about the dialogue and performances, but there's some things that are just like audiovisual set pieces. I'll go first. Robert Pattinson beating the fuck out of this one-eyed seagull.
Uh-huh.
That was just insane. And I mean, clearly, I don't think he really beat a seagull to death. Like, it could have been a dead bird. It could have been a fake bird.
Yeah.
But it just went... It started off as, like, just a person acting out in a fit of pique. But it turned into this, like, enduring, long boiling over rage that I found... like truly frightening. Like, if you saw, like, if you're Willem Dafoe and you're up in the lighthouse and you see that, this man's off his nut.
I'd be scared of it, sure.
Yeah, I thought that was something that I just, like, what an unrestrained in insane performance. Do you got any you want to talk about?
There are 1,000 in this movie. I thought, let's talk about the top of the lighthouse, the actual light compartment of the lighthouse where he's not allowed in. He goes up to that several times and he's trying to look in and see what's going on, and one of those times is Willem Dafoe up there masturbating and his semen is dripping down through the grate and the light is blinding and there are tentacles up there. And it's just like an extraordinarily like repulsive and disturbing and somehow that like even more curious.
Oh, I didn't get that. That's what was happening. Oh, wow.
I mean, I thought it was.
I mean, yeah, like I didn't see that the seagull had one eye either.
Okay.
Which one-eyed seagull? Is that a penis joke too? Like,
oh, you're right.
Because I read that the this interview with Robert Eggers where he said that the lighthouse is intentionally phallic, and in fact there was a scene that they intended to cut from this wide angle, well, as wide as you can get on a box aspect ratio of the lighthouse, and then smash cut to Robert Pattinson's erect penis. And they remove that cut from the final film.
So they do put it in the scene when he's masturbating, right? Out in the shed or whatever. Like they do show a lighthouse intermixed with like the mermaid puss and him jacking it. But they
don't actually cut to his erect, like, you know, full. Like, right. I guess it's going to be 1-to-1. Like his penis would be completely replaced, or his last
like
replaced
a slow fade back and forth.
Who knows? But I guess the financiers of the film requested they remove that. Which, like I said,
was Robert Pattinson a financier of this film? Is that what I'm hearing?
I do think that like that might have been a smart cut because this film did teeter on the edge of self-parody and ridiculousness.
Yeah.
It never came even close to that. But that's, you know, it's one of those things where it's like once you go too far, you can't come back. Mm-hmm. You know. You can't act sane once everyone sees that you're crazy. Pattinson tries on this.
You got any other set pieces? Because I got at least one more. If I want to talk about more of the lighthouse and the top of it.
Yeah, because that's the penultimate sequence,
yes, okay,
where he goes up and looks in directly into this thing's Fresnel lens, and we talked about the silver screen effect and how like crazy the contrast is, but I feel like they just kept on opening up the shutter and opening up the shutter and Robert Pattinson's face dissolving into this horrific demonic visage of just light and shadow and angles and screaming,
yeah,
and the sound, the foghorn being remixed and over distorted. And like, I felt like it was going to destroy my speakers.
I felt like it was going to destroy Robert Pattinson's throat, like the way he's screaming.
I don't know what, I mean, that's just a visual that defies description. It's something that's worth the price of admission all by itself. Just to like, you're watching that just like, what does this mean? What is he seeing? What is he feeling?
And I saw a lot of reviews asking that direct question, like, what did he see in the light? And I never even thought to ask that question when I was watching it. It's just it's a man losing his mind.
Yeah, yeah. Like you should have asked that question 5 gallons of turpentine ago. Like you might have gotten an answer, but like at this point, I almost think the movie might have been stronger without the overt Prometheus shot at the end of the, because, you know, that does bring it to the literary analysis of like a seventh grade, you know, gifted, talented lit program, right?
Yeah.
Like him screaming into the lighthouse and just fading to black might have been. But I don't know. You could almost say the same thing about The Witch, right? Like if they had ended with her conversation with Black Phillip. And then didn't go, spoilers for The Witch, spoilers for a 5-year-old movie. They didn't show her like literally getting naked with other witches and floating into the air.
Disagree. Hard disagree.
Really?
That's my favorite shot in The Witch. I think it's so remarkably unsettling. I see why you would say it though. Like, yes,
it seems like
I get what,
thumb
your,
on,
what your point
it,
is here.
Yeah, it, like the film feels heavy hand, but I think that like maybe you're so restrained, kind of like, am I seeing something supernatural here, or am I just seeing crazy people in the woods? Am I seeing something supernatural here, or am I just seeing a man losing his mind because he's drinking turpentine and he's been alone for 6 weeks and he's malnourished and all this stuff? Yeah. Like, maybe the film earns like putting its thumb on the scale of symbolism. But I did feel like that, like I immediately got it. Like, oh, he's Prometheus. Look at him. He's getting his liver pecked out literally by a seagull.
Right.
But that last visual was so bonkers and so otherworldly and so just the picture of a man losing his mind that it is almost anticlimactic to end with the bird pecking his liver out. As crazy as that sounds, right?
Right. No, it's. Yeah, that last shot is remarkable. It's also, well, not the last shot. I mean, the last shot is good, I think. I like the Prometheus. Mm-hmm. It's maybe a little too overt, but it does make me go back and want to watch this movie again from that angle and see what they're getting at. Because I feel like there's a lot of mud in there, right? Like, there's a lot of fog in the Prometheus myth within this movie. And I don't know if it's trying to tell me that he is in fact Prometheus, or that Prometheus was something he was aspiring to and failed, or what. He certainly gets the same punishment, but that scene where he's looking into the light, even before it starts to do all of its crazy, white out kind of stuff, the light itself is beautiful. Like the construction, it's something that I can only, like, we recently covered Devs, and we were talking about how beautiful the computer, the quantum computer, was within, that whole show. It's something like that. It's something like Annihilation, where you see this image that is so beautiful that you can't really even take in what you're seeing. And like the cinematography here is just so freaking good, and that's part of what makes this just a great film.
Yeah, those Fresnel lenses are remarkably beautiful. They look like some kind of tesseract, six-dimensional construct when they're rotating, and there's just all these like prisms stacked on prisms, and they're a real thing. Like they're these works of physics and engineering marvel. They're really rare because most of them got destroyed. Some of them are preserved in museums and whatnot. But yeah, like you're right. That was just a. You can kind of understand why Willem Dafoe, if he was a real person and not a figment of Robert Pattinson's imagination or subconscious, would be jealous preserving that intimate relationship that he had with that innermost part of the lighthouse.
Mm-hmm.
There's one other question I had, and this is the thing that I want to explore in further watches, but like there's this thing with Robert Pattinson's relationship with the foreman that you find out he took his name and took his identity. What do you think actually happened? Because I don't think that what the movie said, where he essentially, this guy got caught in this rolling surf with the logs in it and got crushed to death. And I think he took a little, my gut feeling is Robert Pattinson's character took a lot more of a hand in killing him, because you hear about this foreman, how he was always riding him and he was critical. And he also, like, if there's any homoeroticism there between him and Willem Dafoe, like, I noticed how strikingly attractive the man was too.
Oh, okay.
And like, there might be like this kind of self-hating homosexuality at this character.
Certainly could be.
What's your take on this?
So I think the movie tells you two things. One, very overtly, and this is why I'm kind of interested to go back with the Prometheus stuff, but one very overtly and one a little more subtly. So he's got the story like, oh, you know, it was an accident, he fell in and I just stood there and watched him. The key thing, I think, is when he says, and afterward, all I could think was, I want to smoke. And if you go then and you look at when he kills Willem Dafoe, with the axe, the very first thing he does is turn around and light a cigarette. And in my opinion, I think what the movie is saying there is that, yes, he did in fact kill that foreman.
Okay. That actually tracks pretty, because there's also something in Willem Dafoe's description of like his surviving a shipwreck that made me think there was a mirror of those two things.
Yeah.
That like, you know, maybe Willem Dafoe literally had the same story as Robert Pattinson, which, also, again, I'm going to be looking for the fact that, like, maybe Willem Dafoe literally is Robert Pattinson or an aspect of his consciousness. But, like, because I was using that to try to figure out, it's like, oh, well, if he's lying, because you could see that Robert Pattinson was like, hey, no, wait a second. You just said that this guy did this, but then you said he did that. And like, how is that possible? And yeah. How do you chew grass if you don't got any teeth? I thought there is a mirroring of the two men spilling their beans about their deepest, darkest secrets. That
and what you mentioned about like the bleeding of the conscious and the subconscious, right? Why'd you spill the beans? It's almost like the subconscious asking the conscious why you admitted what you did. You know, it's
we
like,
came out here to get a fresh start. Why are you tormenting us with this?
Yeah.
Man, what a film, though.
I agree.
What a film.
I thought it was incredible.
Do you got anything else you want to say?
No.
Okay. Well, we have another black and white thriller banger for you. Next week, if you come back to the Prestige feed, because we're going to be looking. I think this is a first for Bald Move. We've never covered an Alfred Hitchcock film. So someone, after we got done doing the Hustler, we're on a little bit of a black and white kick here. They said that they wanted us to do a Hitchcock, as we'd never done one before. So I put up a poll, and the number one by a 2-1 margin, the Bald Move fandom selected a Hitchcock's classic Rear Window. Starring
Johnny Depp movie, right?
No, what? I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, it's there's a secret window, I think is what it's called or something.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
I've heard that this is essentially the Shia LaBeouf film Suburbia remade. Oh. But it's a classic Hitchcock film, stars Jimmy Stewart, the beautiful Grace Kelly, and Raymond Burr. You might wonder, like, well, how did this win with if you put Birds and Psycho on the poll? It's because I left Birds and Psycho off. I figured that everybody would pick those films, which I've seen both of them, and I wasn't as interested as in doing that as something a little bit more. Not that you can find any film of Hitchcock's as truly off menu or off the beaten path. They're all pretty famous in their own right. But we'll be talking about the Rear Window, a classic suspense, a psychological thriller next week. So come back to Bald Move Premium. Bald Move Prestige to enjoy that. And until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.